Now, Germany, to which we must now come, was behind, as I said, in solving the problem of religious or national unity. And it was behind for a reason that you must realize, that the Peace of Augsburg of 1555 had served Germany well as a whole. But when the religious conflict broke out in 1618, it was to be, in a way, a world war in the definition of the world of the 17th century. It was to take in most of the nations then in existence. And the reason for that is, of course, geography, the situation of Germany, and the problems of the empire. The 30 Years' War was to go beyond the religious issues involved, as did all the religious wars. But in Germany, or in the geographical area we call Germany, there were two special factors which you must bear in mind. Unlike France, or in fact the Netherlands, Germany was only a geographical term. It had no kind of political unity. Charles V had not unified it. The Peace of Augsburg meant, in fact, virtual independence of all the 300-odd princes and cities in the empire. Secondly, Germany's geographical location meant that its war was wide open to foreign influence. Denmark, Sweden, France all entered it, as did Spain. Thus it became, as I said before, a European war. Now, what really began the war? What began the religious conflict was really an interplay of two situations which came about in the early part of the 17th century and which were, as we would say, ripe by 1618. The first situation is this. For the first time since Charles I, a strong emperor had ascended the throne. And that was a figure of the Catholic Reformation. Ferdinand II was no longer a Christian humanist. He was like Philip II, devoted. As he said, he would rather live in exile and beg his bread than suffer one insult to the true religion. But as always, religion went hand in hand with political ambition. He had himself pictured with the crown of Charlemagne on his head. And he wanted to unify the empire. And he wanted to unify it under Catholicism. And he dreamt of a Catholic unified empire, like a nation state, in a way. But he came to the empire at a singularly unfortunate, if you like, juncture of affairs, namely when Calvinism had begun making inroads, and Calvinism was not a part of the Peace of Augsburg. That wouldn't have been so fatal. But Calvinism made the inroads in one German state, namely the Palatinate. Now there's much question on how much guilt for the war can be laid at the emperor's door. But there's very little question that the Calvinist Palatinate tried confrontation. For the Calvinist Palatinate, under Calvinist guidance, pursued an aggressively anti-Catholic and anti-Habsburg policy, and had pursued it for half a century. The counts of the Palatinate were devoted Calvinists. They believed that you couldn't compromise with Satan, and Satan was Catholicism. Satan was the House of Habsburg, and with that you couldn't compromise. Moreover, they believed, wrongly, but they believed, that the Habsburgs wanted to crush Protestantism. They looked at the religious wars in France. They looked at Philip II's conflict with the Netherlands. They looked at these religious wars in France and the Netherlands, and they said, being near to the Netherlands geographically, they said, well, after all, it seems as if the Catholics wanted to crush Protestants. The emperor wants to crush us. And Spain wants to crush us. So we might as well have, as you would say, confrontation as soon as possible. What it meant was that the Palatinate was out to destroy the Habsburg Empire, and they thought their chance had come. They had come in 1618, when the Bohemian nobility rose at the other side of Europe against the emperor, when the Bohemian nobility rose for Protestantism. And at that point, they thought the time had come, and Frederick of the Palatinate accepted the crown of Bohemia. Now you say, why is that such a confrontation? It is such a confrontation because traditionally the emperor was the king of Bohemia. And therefore, by accepting the crown of Bohemia, the Palatinate was taking away one of the principal parts of the empire. By linking it with Protestantism, it was throwing down the gauntlet to Ferdinand II, who did have ambitions for the empire and for Catholicism. Now, as you know, the thing went badly. Ferdinand got beaten in the famous Battle of the White Mountain, which ended Protestantism almost forever in that region of Europe. He got invaded and driven out of the Palatinate. But what is important to remember, that even in exile in the Netherlands, the court of the Palatinate continued to pursue this aggressive policy. Frederick's Bohemian adventure, if you want to call it that, sparked 30 years of war. But it carried 60 years of anti-Catholic and anti-Habsburg policy to its logical conclusion. Frederick himself in exile was the force to encourage the King of Sweden to intervene in the 30 Years' War. He was the force to encourage Gustavus Adolphus on his famous adventure. So it was by no means ineffective. But as a matter of fact, not till 1648 did the Count of the Palatinate, of course not Frederick but his son, was able to return to the Palatinate itself. So from their point of view, it was bad. But it's not only that the Palatinate lost. The Protestants were disunited. And under the challenge of Bohemia, the Catholics united at once. The Protestants were disunited. Why? Because the Lutheran princes said, "A plague on your houses. We are quite satisfied with the Peace of Augsburg. We don't want to upset the Peace of Augsburg. We hate the Calvinists worse than the Catholics." And therefore, the Lutheran princes, by and large, throughout the 30 years, tried to occupy a middle ground. They didn't really join the Calvinists. They didn't join the Catholics, except occasionally. They said, in a way, a plague on both your houses. Serious for Protestantism, because the Lutheran princes were the bulk of the Protestant power in Germany. But the Catholics had no such problem. For one thing, Spain came immediately to the aid of Ferdinand. The Habsburg front was immediately re-established, after all. And this was a highly successful. By 1629, Protestantism was crushed in the empire. By 1629, the Calvinists had been defeated on every score. By 1629, it seemed as if the Reformation had been utterly undone. But it turned out that Ferdinand didn't really want to crush Protestantism, as the Palatinate had alleged. Because in 1629, he passed an edict, you will read about, the Edict of Restitution. To be sure, it's called restitution because all possible territories were restituted to Catholic princes and Catholic authorities. But Ferdinand left the Lutherans alone. He left the Lutherans by and large alone. It hadn't been true, as the Palatinate alleged, that the emperor wanted to crush Protestantism. In that sense, the war had started on a misunderstanding, if you like. By 1629, Spain had for the last time played a leading part in Europe. After all, Spain provided again much of the army and leadership for the Emperor's cause now. But the War of the Netherlands had drained it. And after 1629, Spain collapses, and collapses very suddenly, and collapses thoroughly, and will never play, as you will see, a dominant role again. It had exhausted itself in bringing about this victory. Now, why did the victory not last? Here, geography asserted itself, and asserted itself very strongly. Why? Because now Protestantism is saved, and it is saved, as you know, by Sweden, by Gustavus Adolphus, prodded by the exiled Palatinate court. Now, why did Gustavus Adolphus interfere? Well, for religious reasons, no doubt. He fancied himself as what he became. That doesn't happen very often in life. He fancied himself as a savior of German Protestantism, and that is what he became. But he fancied himself as more than that, the King of Sweden. He fancied himself, in effect, as the new Protestant emperor. He thought that if he conquered, he could be the new emperor, but this time a Protestant emperor. But secondly, the immediate reason is geographical. In 1629, a Catholic emperor controlled Germany. What did that mean? It meant, don't look so puzzled, it is geography, yes. It meant control of the Baltic ports. And the Baltic ports controlled by a strong empire. What did that mean? That meant a challenge to Sweden in the Baltic. And Sweden had dreamt of herself as the prime power at the Baltic. But with a strong emperor at Rostock and other important ports, that dream would go up in smoke. And so Gustavus Adolphus made his famous statement, which you will read in the source book, that if we do not meet them in Germany, they will meet us in Sweden. Well, that's very nice, but unlikely. What he really meant was that if we don't go and defeat the emperor, our dream of the hegemony of the Baltic will be go up in smoke, will be dead. Sweden will become a mere second-rate power. Ferdinand did not see his dreams dissolve. He died before the Swedish intervention. Gustavus Adolphus, as you know, was highly successful, but he died in battle too in 1632. His dreams too dissolved, that of being a Protestant empire. But once Gustavus Adolphus had died, once he had won his battles, he had upset the balance enough for the war to carry on in a dreary way for another almost 2 decades. For now that the great figures like Ferdinand and Gustavus Adolphus have left the scene, the war becomes, in a way, a war of attrition. The man typical for that part of the war is neither Gustavus Adolphus, a man of certainly great stature, Ferdinand of great stature, but rather Wallenstein, the Prague mercenary captain, out for power alone, all the time negotiating with the opposite sides, in the emperor's service, but negotiating with the Protestants for better pay and better terms, acting exactly like the mercenary captains of the Renaissance, only he didn't want cash, he wanted political power. He had his men swear loyalty to him rather than to the emperor, and in the end, to be sure, Ferdinand had him assassinated. But Wallenstein is very typical for the kind of mercenary captain who now dominates it, not really wedded to any side, but switching around as to where he could get best power. In fact, if you like, the war became a kind of industry, as all wars did. That's nothing new. For the little German princes lived off it. A little German prince with his bankrupt little country would raise an army, and he would sell the army to the biggest bidder, whether Protestant or Catholic, whether the emperor or the Swedes, doesn't really make much difference. and so he would make a lot of money. And a lot of people got, as you would say, an extremely great vested interest in the whole affair. And peace was the thing they would, of course, fear more. Most. Now, all this wouldn't have been so serious if there wasn't another man around who had real power and who feared peace more than these little princes, or could do more about it, or more than Wallenstein and people like him. And that man was Cardinal Richelieu of France. For Richelieu, quite rightly from his point of view, saw that France must intervene. Why must France intervene? Because France is in the same position as Gustavus Adolphus, a strong empire on its flank, very dangerous. Remember, it's just spent a lot of time, money, and effort to disentangle itself from Charles V. It didn't want to see a new empire on its flanks. Obvious. And Richelieu also believed that here France could now get what he called its natural frontiers. The first time that that term was used, you will see why, as part of the build-up of the French monarchy. But the natural frontiers, no longer dynastic frontiers, not what you know have by heritage, but the first time an idea of national interest, an idea of national interest which didn't exist before the French monarchy had been built up on this absolutist idea. For Richelieu now said, what is important for France are her natural frontiers. What are those? Well, you can make up, you can guess that. No, I'm sorry, you can't. Well, the Rhine, the Alps, and the Pyrenees. The Rhine, the Alps, and the Pyrenees, the natural frontiers. What do we mean by natural frontiers? The frontiers enemy armies can't cross, or will find very difficult to cross. The Rhine, well, you know how important that was in keeping the Netherlands independent. 17th century army could not easily cross a big river. The Alps and the Pyrenees, mountain chains, easily defensible. But Richelieu intervened then for the reason of keeping Germany disunited, but he also intervened because he had for the first time this idea of national interest, natural frontiers, not merely dynastic, not merely hereditary, not merely what you had, as it were, inherited. Richelieu's intervention dragged out the war to its dreary close. It dragged it out despite the fact that the Lutheran princes tried to mediate. For as I said, you must remember, the Lutherans equally hated the Catholics and the Calvinists and made scarce distinctions between them. They tried to mediate, but without any real great success, especially Saxony, which had stood aside from the war altogether. Eventually, the war ended in what we call the Peace of Westphalia of 1648. Peace, which will be general, because the war was general. Now, what do we mean by a peace, first of all, in that time? Well, I don't know how you picture peace. I know how you picture peace, because we are very old-fashioned again. You think all these great statesmen come around, sit around a blue table, and sign a peace with big quill pens and shake hands. Well, no, that's not quite how it worked. A peace was done piecemeal. And what we actually call the Peace of Westphalia are all sorts of little agreements to stop fighting between all sorts of principalities, which I can't remember all of them, but you certainly shouldn't have to remember them, because in the long run, this part of it is not of overwhelming importance. The Peace of Westphalia, then, was a series of little conferences and pieces in the city of Münster, the center of Westphalia, and what you will read about are the more general settlements. The more general settlements. Above all, the settlement on religion, which is a settlement on politics, which simply confirmed the Peace of Augsburg and added the Calvinists to it. That's all it did. It confirmed the Peace of Augsburg and added the Calvinists to it, That's all that that peace settlement in religion and politics, in a sense, did. But its consequences were enormous and reach far into modern times. Let me then talk now about the consequences of this peace, which is of central importance. For essentially, it will last until the French Revolution. The landscape will change a little, but it won't change much for almost 200 years. Only the peace in Vienna, only the peace after Napoleon in 1815 is of similar importance. Now, what are the consequences? Now, first of all, the beneficiary was France. Richelieu didn't allow this until he'd reached his aim. The beneficiary was France. The war, once for all, removed the possibility of a strong and united empire. And as a side benefit, it hastened the collapse of Spain. What success! No major power on the other side of the Rhine, no major power on the other side of the Pyrenees. That was a great success for France, because it meant indeed that France had a great liberty of action. Therefore, the second half of the 17th century begins the great age of France, an age that will stretch from 1648 to 1815. The age of Spain is over, and it's over so fast that by the middle of the 17th century, the King of France will decide who sits on the throne of Spain. It's that fast. Once a nation slips, it usually slips pretty fast under those conditions. By the middle of the century, really by the end of the 30 Years' War, a little later, a king of France can decide who sits on the throne of Spain. From the age of Charles V and Philip II, that is quite a change. Of course, the Spanish monarchy declined. The last Spanish king was, in fact, clinically an imbecile. He had to be fed. But that undoubtedly had a lot to do with it. Well, we come back to that. Secondly, Germany was now firmed in disunity. And you are here with, well, commanded, that's not popular, not to use the word Germany anymore. Not in this course, because it no longer exists. What you call Germany is now merely a geographical entity of 300 separate political units. Until 1870, Germany only existed in dreams, but not in reality. The clause of the Peace of Westphalia, which you read in your source book, makes this totally clear. Every prince is now sovereign. Every city is now sovereign. Now, what about the emperor? And now comes something very important, which you must understand now, or you'll get everything else fouled up, and fouled up a great deal. The emperor retains the title. There is still an emperor. But he retains control only over those territories which he has, not because he is the emperor, but because he is a Habsburg, only over the inherited Habsburg territories. What are these territories? Austria, Hungary, and of course, Bohemia, including Prague. Bohemia and Moravia, to be technically correct, but what is now Czechoslovakia. He retained these territories. Austria, the original Habsburg inheritance, the feudal fief with the Habsburgs had had ever since the Middle Ages. Hungary, inherited by Charles V when the Turks killed off in the Battle of the Mohawks all the Hungarian nobility and king. So Charles V inherited Hungary. Bohemia and Moravia conquered from the Palatinate in the 30 Years' War, reasserted Habsburg rule and Catholicism over Bohemia and Moravia. We therefore from now on call the Emperor of Austria-Hungary. This is the beginning of Austria-Hungary. The Emperor of Austria-Hungary, as long as you remember, and remember carefully, that Moravia and Bohemia are a part of that empire, and so eventually is a part of Galicia. In other words, the Emperor of Austria-Hungary ruled over more than just Austria and Hungary, but the title emperor was archaic. The empire itself, which no longer really exists, was abolished only by Napoleon. But what Napoleon eventually abolished in 1806 is a dead corpse. A dead corpse, it no longer existed. The great monarchy of Austria-Hungary now becomes a separate and important entity in European politics until 1918, with its separate territories, perhaps for many of you a concept, because many of your ancestors came from Austria-Hungary, I'm sure. So that Austria-Hungary now becomes a separate entity. But what in Germany itself? Those 300 pieces, already there are stirrings of the future, north and south. And how did you get anywhere in Germany? Well, how do you get anywhere anyhow? By choosing the right side at the right time. And there were two territories who'd had a genius in the 30 Years' War. That means, technically, first you're with the Catholic Emperor, then you switch to Sweden, and you have to end up with France. That's what you had to do to really make hay. Now, these two territories which did this, and there were, oddly enough, only two who guessed right at every turn, benefited. In the north, who? The elector of an arid piece of land by the name of Brandenburg, who, however, already owned an equally unimportant piece of land in the east known as Prussia, the secularized territory of a religious order, actually, of the Teutonic Knights, but secularized already passed, for all intents and purposes, under Prussia. The elector of Brandenburg, Prussia, who had guessed right at every opportunity, now got new territories on the Rhine and was allowed to take the title King of Prussia. The north is already stirring. A new and dynamic territory is already on the march. Who had guessed right in the south? The good old Catholic King of Bavaria. That he was as black as we would say, and as pious, hadn't really stopped the King of Bavaria from allying with the Swedes and helping to save Protestantism, and it certainly sent them into the arms of France. So that Bavaria gets more territory. There is no doubt that in 1648, Bavaria dominates the south. Now it must be clear then, in spite of these stirrings, north and south, politically this is the end of the empire. The dream of Charles V is complete. Victory rests with, in a sense, the nation states, who also now, all 300 of them, entered various degrees the stages of absolutism, were free to imitate France and Louis XIV, were free, in other words, to imitate the new stage of the nation state. Thirdly, as if another far-reaching effect, the impact of the war on what has sometimes been called the German national character must at least be mentioned. Now, I don't really believe in national character, particularly. Don't quite know what that is. But let's put it a little differently and without these racial overtones of national character. The influence on the German national dream, on the myth. Everybody lives by myths, I've told you that before. And the myth, the German national myth, was not to die out. And the myth was, of course, that bad France had divided up Germany in the 30 Years' War, and that the unity of Germany was due to the evil of France. And that myth will never die. And it will play into what you would call the 300-year enmity between Germany and France, which now starts. An enmity which is only a little in the future. For as a matter of fact, after 1648, the German ruling classes speak French, the cultured Germans speak French, and German becomes, as Frederick the Great said, a language for the servant class only. The French cultural takeover was almost complete. Now why? And if we say that this third consequence is the consequence of the hatred of France and the dream of German unity, that myth which will go on under some classes of the population, now more, now less, means the enmity against France, even while French culture sweeps Germany. Then fourthly, why? Why? What happened to German culture and to the tenure of German life? In the source book, you will read an extract from the most important work published during the 30 Years' War, the so-called Simplicissimus, which simply means in English, the simpleton. This novel, one of the first German novels in a sense, published during the 30 Years' War, shows, of course, the despair, the world without purpose, telling the truth laughingly, without having any concern for the fate of Germany at all. The only concern of Simplicissimus is for himself and for his problem of existence. It is, and it has been called rightly in a way, the first existentialist work. It is, in a way, the first existentialist work, for it is completely withdrawn from any of those concerns which people have at times for life in general, but it is a complete despair, despair with Germany, with the world which is evil and nothing but evil, because Simplicissimus goes from one adventure where the evil of man is manifest to another adventure where the evil of man is manifest. And so he ends up telling the truth laughingly, caring for nothing. Almost, if you have read Sartre's play The Wall, almost like the man who is about to be shot and shrugs his shoulder. So what? This is the kind of idea that you have in Simplicissimus. And it has been taken to characterize the decline of German culture. For it is true that universities then sold their degrees for cash. This also is true. Now, what you have is, however, not that. The 19th century had thought Germany declined because the real culture of the 17th century in Germany, they hated, and that was the Baroque. But the Baroque did not decline in Germany. In fact, in architecture, in building, the 30 Years' War did not bring forth a decline. Most of Germany's most beautiful Baroque buildings, churches, date from the late 17th century. But those who wrote history in the 19th century didn't like the Baroque. They thought the Baroque was itself a sign of decline, because they liked the classics. They were taken with the classics. So that they said, there is no culture, look what happened, only Simplicissimus. But that is not true. What is true, however, that as Paris became a political magnate, it also became a cultural center of attraction. And what is true is Germany lacked a capital. To be sure, in the 18th century, the little Duchess of Weimar will become one, but that is still over a century away. As Germany lacked any capital, any center, they looked to the center of Paris. And French language became the language for all but the servant classes. French literature became the literature to be discussed and read. And Germans from now on wrote more in French than they wrote in English. This is, of course, the great triumph of Louis XIV, not just the triumph of political power, but also the triumph of culture, and obviously, against that state of affairs, the German myth will revolt, but not until the 18th century. Not until the 18th century will you have the revolt against this kind of French predominance, with the beginning of great classical literature in Germany, with Schiller and Goethe and the others, many of whom revolted against this French predominance. But not immediately. Immediately it was accepted. What about the destruction of Germany, the physical, the economic destruction, 30 years of war? This has been the most discussed thing about the war, for one very simple reason: we don't have any statistics. The science of statistics doesn't really start until the end of the 17th century. You don't really have any statistics. So how can you really tell how much destruction you had? We can only guess. Remember that this is true about everything we study now. There are no statistics. In statistical terms, most of what we can do is only guess. Now, we know several things. Small-scale agriculture was ruined in many areas. Obviously, the peasant gets it first. Armies, remember what armies were. I haven't pointed it out yet. These mercenary armies lived off the country. They were billeted in houses. They didn't pay for anything. That wasn't the idea. They were billeted on people, and people had to feed them and give them their daughters, usually in the bargain. This becomes quite important in the English Revolution. And not only that, but of course, they took the peasants' grain and everything. So where they were, the small peasant was worse hit. It did mean, therefore, a certain migration within Germany, an inner German migration to the towns. Yet all we can say is that there was ruin in some areas while it wasn't so bad in others. It's obvious that when a town was burnt down, and the way the war was fought is often the towns were simply burnt down in terrorem, as a terror sort of thing. When the town of Magdeburg was burnt down by the Catholic Empire General Tilly, for example, obviously that was very basic destruction. But it didn't apparently apply to every region equally. All that we can say, without bothering you with detail, that the war drastically reduced the number of prosperous areas in Germany. That is about all we can say. We are no longer saying what they used to say, especially the Protestant historians, of course, in the 19th century, that the 30 Years' War eliminated half of the German population. There is no evidence for that whatsoever. No evidence for that whatsoever. To be sure, the greatest scourge weren't the armies. You mustn't think of it that way. It was the billeting, the taking of things. But remember again what an army was. You think of armies of soldiers. No, no, no. These armies carried everything with them. Above all, and this was the greatest problem, their women. And the women spread syphilis. That was the problem with the army. This was the military problem of the 17th century. Really? Well, it was a serious problem. Because if you imagine that these armies weren't small, Wallenstein's army had some 20 to 30,000 men and another 20 to 30,000 women and servants and what went with it, going through the countryside, helping themselves to things. All sorts of things, obviously. You have a serious problem on your hands, right? Anyhow, however that might be, it nevertheless meant not a drop in births, obviously. But as people had thought, there is no reason to think that there was. Wars don't diminish births, you know, by and large. Even the First World War, the bloodiest war in history, the birth control rises very soon thereafter again. It does don't necessarily do that, and we have no evidence that the 30 Years' War did this, by the way. So all that we can say, there was ruin. There was undoubtedly a retardation of economic life. I don't want to say there wasn't, but these are problems which it is, in the absence of statistics, very, very difficult to solve. Germany became a backwater. Nobody doubts that. Remember how much in the front of things Germany was. The Reformation, Christian humanism, all this in Germany. But for the next 200 years, nothing, nothing at all. A little bit of poetry, opitz, well, it wouldn't send anybody. Simplicissimus, but all, nothing. For the next 200 years, oh, a little Baroque poetry, yes. A little bit of Baroque poetry. The only thing that survives is a Protestant hymn. We now enter in the Lutheran regions after the war in the great age of the Protestant hymn. This is quite right. We now age. If you have sung your hymns in church, I will bet you that 50% date from the 17th and 18th century great revival in Germany. But what sort of hymns were they? Hymns of the cross and consolation. In other words, hymns of consolation in evil times. That is the great revival of poetry and hymns now, after this dreadful war, hymns of the cross and consolation. But otherwise, Germany becomes a backwater. And what is now the nation that comes to the front? It's France. Germans looked now not to Wittenberg, to Geneva, or even to Rome. But Paris is really what emerged victoriously from the 30 Years' War. Paris politically, Paris culturally, the court of Louis XIV. And if you ever go to Germany, you will see almost every 50 miles a little Versailles, because the local ruler built himself one. In other words, in many ways you weren't anything among German rulers, however small your territory, unless you had built a little Versailles of one sort or another, and some of them are pretty small. But unless you built a little Versailles. The cultural decline was perhaps more important than the other. Why? Because the cultural revival will be violent. The more the decline, the more violent the revival. And of course, this will explain to you, to a certain extent, something that comes later, the kind of violence of German nationalism. But in the universities, degrees were sold for cash, for example. Well, I know somewhere that's done right now, not this one. If we abolish grades, maybe. Well, never mind. Degrees were sold by cash. I know I'd get a rise out of you. I just wanted to see whether you'd all fallen asleep. So, like this lady here slept during most of it. But you look very refreshed and pretty. That's for women, that's perhaps more important. So, for a woman, that's more important. So anyhow, very reactionary. Just feel reactionary today. Don't you ever have that? One day you feel liberal, one day you feel reactionary. So, I guess I'm just like Simplicissimus, and I'm accused by my student friends of not taking things seriously enough. However, and they're probably quite correct, but quite apart from all of this, it is therefore very important, after you have gotten all that and followed the 30 Years' War, to understand then two things. First of all these things are interrelated, and I must make it always clear to you. One thing is interrelated to another. And the growth of the French monarchy is related to the 30 Years' War, to what happened, the strength of the French monarchy, and especially, of course, the reign of Richelieu. And secondly, that strength of the French monarchy and the rebuilding after the French religious wars will mean, in effect, something which has remained true, has it not, for many of you? Not, I think, for me so much, but for many, that Paris became the center of the universe. And there's much to be said for that. So that we must next Monday, then, come to Paris and to Louis XIV himself.